Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 2nd, 1999. We're in the fireside room of Koinonia this evening. Your presenter's name is Cynthia Molibito. Today's session number is 99-3 and is titled Free Trade and Investment. Let's listen in.
Blend out.
Well, maybe we will get started. For the tapers, we're starting. I am Cynthia Molibito. I'm a doctoral student in Christian ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York. My work in this subject matter is being done there, but it stems from a long history of being a missionary in Honduras and also serving as the director of the Washington, D.C. Office of the Center for Global Education, which many of you may know at Augsburg College. And that's where some of the grounding and the fuel for this kind of work is coming from for me. What I thought we would do this evening is do a brief overview of the subject matter of these five sessions and then dig into some new material. We've done a lot of discussion in the previous sessions, and I've been asked by a few people to just even say more. So I may be a little bit more of a lecturer type person than I have been in previous sessions, but we'll see how that goes. Let us begin simply by trying to succinctly review the subject matter of these five times together. What I have suggested that we do is grapple with a contradiction which to me is gut-wrenching, terrifying. And the contradiction has to do with our call. We are called to love neighbor. As Jesus said, no other commandment is greater than love thy God and love thy neighbor. And we are called to choose life for this good earth. The Deuteronomic historian says it beautifully. In the words of Moses, before the people go across the Jordan into the promised land, I put before you blessing and curse, life and death. Choose life so that you and your descendants might live. I understand these to be our call, but not only our call, our gift, that this is the life that we as people of the God of Scriptures are given. A life that serves the well-being of creation by loving, active, embodied love, and by choosing life for creation. I would bet that all of us long to fulfill that life, that calling, and that gift. But in contrast, in stunning and tragic contrast, we end up locked into complicity with global economic systems that brutalize people who are poor and that devastate the earth to the extent that we now threaten the capacity of the earth to sustain life as we know and love it for our children and their children. And we could almost just stop right there and meditate. What does it mean to live that way, acquiescent to economic structures that put us into bondage, a bondage of devastating both earth and neighbor. I know that the claim that, I am claiming that the economic ways by which we live deal death. And I know that that is very contestable and that I could cite tons of statistics to justify my claim. I don't want to spend time doing that. In previous sessions, I've simply shared a couple of voices. And I wasn't going to reshare them, but maybe since there are so many new people, I'll share a couple of those. One is a voice of a Mexican strawberry worker that I met in my work with the Center for Global Education, who simply said to me, you know, our children are dying because our land is growing these strawberries for your tables. Another voice is the bishop, a Methodist bishop in Mozambique, with whom I recently spoke on a panel at the UN. And he basically said that the economic structures by which North American citizens live are covered with blood, and it's the blood of African children. Another voice that we read is from, well, I'll read one other voice. I'll just read it. This is Martin Kaur, who's from Malaysia. He's an activist and an economist, and he says, via their domination of the new global systems of trade and finance, the industrial countries have rapidly sucked out forest, mineral, and metal resources from the third world and used its land and labor resources. The industrial nations, approximately one-fifth of the world's population, use up four-fifths of the world's resources, mostly for making luxury products. Only a small portion of the world's resources serve the basic needs of the poor majority in the third world, who seep deeper into the trough of poverty and destitution. The very process of extracting third world resources results in environmental disasters and such as massive soil erosion and desertification, pollution of water supplies, etc. This is the ultimate environmental and social tragedy of our age. Another document pointed out that we in the US and Europe spend annually on cosmetics and pet food what could provide safe drinking water, food, and health care for everyone in the world that doesn't have it. Now, I don't want to sit and wallow here. I don't want us to sink into the pits of despair that all of us have probably sunk into that have read these kinds of statements before. That's not my intent. I simply intend those statements as a way of giving voice to my claim that life as we live it, according to our economic ways, does spell death and that it contradicts our calling. So, my purpose in these sessions isn't just to wallow in that, but to move towards God-filled, God-given, and grace-filled paths toward alternatives. How do we, as the people of love and life, the people of Yahweh, move towards alternatives? Toward that end, toward uncovering spirit-filled paths toward alternatives, I've proposed two questions with which we, for us to grapple with. One of them is this, and they're simple questions. If the prevailing model of economic globalization brutalizes many who are poor and jeopardizes the earth's regenerative capacities, then why do Christians in the U.S. acquiesce to those systems without declaring them an affront to our faith in Jesus Christ? What could be powerful enough for us to accept an economic status quo which leads to millions of silent deaths? I will propose that we discuss this notion that economic globalization in its current dominant form disables or corrodes our moral power. That is our power to live unto our call to love neighbor and choose life. That power is corroded and we don't even know it's being corroded. The second question before us is, where in our Christian faith tradition are we offered hope and spiritual moral power to resist and revision and rebuild economic ways that nurture communities and the earth community according to compassion and justice for generations to come? And I am going to suggest that the traditions of Christian mysticism, that is the belief that God, with God's fierce and tender love for all of creation, lives in us, courses through our veins, and gives us power to live toward our call. So these are the two questions I've put before us and two routes of two paths to explore. That's a summary. What we did in the first session was look at those questions. What we did in the second was really do an overview of what economic globalization today is. What I'd like to do today is maybe the most difficult terrain, maybe the most boring terrain. It's really to dig into some of the power dynamics at play in the corporate-driven model of globalization. I think the temptation to run from this kind of subject is big. It was big for me. It seems boring and it seems impenetrable. But I would say that to run from understanding the power dynamics at play and the consequences of the economy as we know it is to run from many, many voices who are crying out that the economy as we know it spells death for them and their children. And to not get a grip and understand some of this is to remain in blindness and to refuse to hear those voices. So I say that be it apparently or seemingly complex and be it seemingly boring, we had best become literate in economics, in what global the economy is today. So I've suggested that globalization disables our power to live toward our call. And what I'd like to do today is kind of untangle one complex web whereby that disabling occurs. And here's the web I'd like to untangle. I would suggest that the prevailing model of globalization, and let me stop there for a minute and say, we talked about that yesterday. It is fundamentally globalization that is driven by corporate power and that aims at freeing up international trade and investment from any kind of regulations. This is the prevailing model. I'm saying that that model disables our moral power, that is our power to embody love for the other, by disabling democracy. And that the corrosion of democracy essentially disables our moral power to shape economic ways that will sustain the Earth community on into the future. To put it in another term, globalization removes from people, us, the power to influence decisions that shape the common life. And it places that power into the hands of a very few unaccountable players whose power is economic. The power to shape the common life is taken out of our hands and put into a few economically elite hands that are accountable to no one. Now, what in the world does that have to do with the Christian moral life? I would say that the moral and theological significance of the claim I've just made has to be really clear. Decisions to shape the common life are decisions to determine who lives and who dies. The decisions that shape the common life are the decisions that, such as who gets food, who gets shelter, who has human rights, who is human. These are the kinds of decisions I'm talking about that are taken from our hands and put into other hands. And that is the moral and theological significance of my claim that democracy, by which we shape the common life, is disabled by globalization. We who claim to be a democratic people are having our democratic power undermined. Now, this could be sliced many ways, and there are many implications of these terms. And before we go on, I'd like us just to grapple with a couple of these terms, and the first of them is democracy. In a sense, democracy is a word you could even choose not to use because it has so many meanings, so many implications, and it's been so misused and abused. We've seen democracy used to justify terrorism, to justify revolution and counter-revolution. We've used democracy to mean any nation that we support. We've used democracy to mean any nation that has a vote. We've used democracy to mean all kinds of things. Think about Kuwait. I mean, we claim to be supporting democracy in Kuwait. Kuwait was a nation in which only men who had owned property in their families for a certain number of generations could vote. You know, we use democracy very loosely. So I'd like to just take a minute before moving toward my claim that our democracy is being undermined. I'd like us just to take a minute to think, what does democracy mean? What is it when we have democracy? What do we have? Can you think of some things? Can you brainstorm a little bit? Maybe start by pulling apart the word. Does anyone know the Greek roots of the word democracy?
Government by the people.
Government by the people. Demos, the people. Kratia, power or rule. So government by or rule of or power of the demos, the people. What do you mean when you say you live in a democratic country? What are the characteristics of a democracy? Is democracy important? And if it is, why?
The people are the initiators of public policy.
The people are the initiators of public policy, okay? In a democracy, it's the people that initiate public policy. That makes sense to me. Other thoughts?
Well, I'm sitting here hoping you can redeem that word, because the word that comes immediately to my mind is idolatry.
Idolatry?
Yeah.
And meaning?
Meaning that democracy is just another idolatry.
Uh-huh. Idolatry is something that we love above God?
Yeah, by which we try to usurp the power of God.
Uh-huh. And one form in which it maybe is idolatry is that it's used to name things that aren't really democratic.
Well, all the things that you talked about.
Uh-huh. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yes. What, I mean, truly, is democracy important? Maybe let me start there. And what does it mean? Yes.
Referring to me?
Yes, I am.
Well, I feel that for me personally, mm-hmm. the fact that I can vote, mm-hmm. I can have a say in something. Mm-hmm. It may not be much of a say, mm-hmm. but at least it's a saying.
So one characteristic, one aspect of democracy is that everyone can vote. You know, it's easy sometimes to belittle that as insignificant when the vote is often determined by big money and whatever, but what you're saying is very true. Ask anyone in South Africa today and they'll tell you that to vote is truly, truly a magnificent and important element of democracy.
As I said, is democracy important is what I heard you ask as a question.
Well, what I really wanted to ask is, what is it? What do we have when we have democracy? Woody, that's what I'm really asking.
And it seems like, you know, a sense of belonging to a community where you have a say. Where the decisions that are being made, mm-hmm. that you have, your voice is heard in that community.
So in a democracy, your voice is heard, people's voices are heard. And the other thing that was said is, people initiate public policy.
We can't use the black markers.
Yeah, we can't.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just want to put this down so we can come back to it. Initiate public policy. Can't you see it?
It dies a little bit.
Oh, okay, well then we'll remember it.
Seems the link's kind of a little bit indirect, though. I mean, it's the representatives, I mean, you elect the representatives, and they...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a type of democracy. That's a representative democracy.
Right.
What does democracy have to do with equality, or equality of power? Is that significant? Is it important that, in general, everyone has a degree of voice, everyone has a vote, and everyone is involved in has the power to initiate public policy? Or is it okay that just a few if just a few people do?
The people. The bell.
Well, yes.
I think one of our problems is that we don't have the ability to have 200 million people all make public policy. As your structure gets bigger, I mean, mm-hmm. you could do it if you were a community of, you know, 400 people in a village. Mm-hmm. You could have everybody could go to the public meeting place, mm-hmm. and if they wanted to say something, speak to the policy issue, they could have their turn to speak. Mm-hmm. Whereas we don't have a public forum where 200 million people can come to and have a
right,
chance to speak.
Right. So you're talking really about some of the problems of representative democracy, right. in a very large body politic.
As the community gets bigger, mm-hmm. you have a problem.
So
with democracy. Democracy has a problem.
And that's one of the things then that if we value democracy, we grapple with.
Yeah.
Let me suggest a couple of lines of definition that I think take into account all of those, I think, four or five comments. could we say that democracy exists where people have the power to participate with relative equality in forms of communal governance of public life? And that where the equality to participate in shaping public life is diminished, democracy is diminished. Is that a valid claim? So it's perhaps a form of politically organized community that works against inequality and works against domination of one bunch over another bunch. Does that work as a sense of democracy?
Well, that's the theory. In practice, that's not what's going on in this country.
No, I'm not really asking what's going on. I'm asking for us to get a sense of what we claim.
So when we use the word democracy, in this discussion, that's the meaning that we're going to give to the word.
That's the meaning that I would throw out. I also want to look at this word moral power and what I mean when I say that, because it could be mixed up. What I mean is the power to live toward what we are called to do and be. In Christian ethics, we say that the questions of ethics are, what are we to do and be? And when we think about that, our power to live that way is our moral power. And I am saying, for the purposes of this discussion, that our call, what we are to do and be, is to be the embodiment of active love for creation, self, other, and earth. And that to embody active love is to shape public life, social structures, institutions, interpersonal relationships, intrapersonal life, all aspects of life, according to the common good, according to the well-being of creation. I'm calling that our moral life, and our moral power is the power to live towards that. So that's just to get a little grip on what I'm trying to say by democracy and moral power. Let's move back to the main point then. The main point that we'll look at is that corporate-driven globalization disables our moral power by disabling democracy. What I would like to do is examine a case study. This is too big to look at in an hour. I'd like to examine a case study of the dynamics whereby that happens. And the case study that I'd like to examine is a global movement about a decade old in its current form to free trade, international trade, and international investment from regulations. Specifically, we're going to look at the most powerful move in that movement in recent years. The most powerful move in the free trade and investment movement is an international treaty that was called the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. Has anyone heard that word before? A couple people. That'd be interesting just to talk about what you've heard, but I think we won't right now. The MAI is really a marvelous case study because it illustrates, it's a window into what's happening in globalization. It's a window into the power plays, and it's a window into the consequences of globalization. And it's that I hold up as a useful window, since we only have about an hour or so. I'd like to introduce the MAI and then view some of the provisions in the MAI, in this treaty, that are the main provisions and that serve to disable democracy throughout the world. I'm going to read to you about two paragraphs of an introduction to the MAI. It's two paragraphs that I wrote for a lecture elsewhere, and I think it's best to introduce it just by reading and then ask me clarifying questions. The MAI was negotiated, and I'm going to give you one other term. OECD is the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation. Basically, it's an organization of the 29 most industrialized nations that meets in Paris and works on international treaties. The MAI was negotiated in the OECD from 1995 until late 98, in relative secret until 1997. And by secret, I mean Congress didn't know about it. There are letters from many, many Congress people when this was revealed, protesting the fact that they didn't know about this treaty being negotiated. Its purpose, according to supporters and detractors, is to make it easier for individual and corporate investors to move assets, be they money or factories, across international borders. The MAI would accomplish that goal by limiting the legal ability of governments to regulate foreign investment and foreign corporations. The MAI was stopped in the OECD by a worldwide coalition of citizen organizations led by the Canadians and the French. Essentially, those of us who don't like the internet have to see what happened here. The Canadians and the French found out about the MAI and blasted it across the world on the internet. And an incredible coalition, and I'll speak about that coalition, rose up. The French were opposed to it because it was going to endanger French cultural integrity. The Canadians were opposed to it for a lot of economic reasons. They were the leaders of this. I see we have some Canadians in the bunch here. So it was stopped. But the MAI was one agreement. It is understood by both its advocates and its opponents as a movement, an agenda that's being pursued in other international fora. Is anyone familiar with the World Trade Organization and the big meeting happening in Seattle? This will be the next international fora in which the MAI will come up and is coming up. It's one of the most controversial aspects of the WTO. It's being brought up in the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. It's an agenda that will come up elsewhere since it was stopped in the OECD. Among the agreement's most visible supporters are the International Chamber of Commerce and its U.S. affiliate, the U.S. Council of International Business. The main consultants in the negotiations in the OECD were big business, and you can read the documents and see that those were the primary consultants. Basically, the opponents of the MAI and trade and investment deregulation in general include a long list of human rights, labor rights, environmental rights, and anti-poverty groups, led to some extent by church groups, but also secular groups. The opponents also include a long list of cities in the US and Canada, provinces, states, that declared themselves MAI free zones. For instance, Seattle has declared itself an MAI free zone. Olympia, Washington, San Francisco, Denver, a lot of East Coast cities. I think British Columbia as a province, Vancouver itself. A lot of these opponents were led by labor unions, environmental groups, mainstream, not lefty radicals, but really mainstream groups. In Seattle, it's labor that is opposing it. Farmers, North Dakota and South Dakota farmers and Canadian farmers were opposing it. Anyway, these are some of the opponents. The opponents of this movement, and particularly this agreement, call it a corporate bill of rights, NAFTA on steroids. Does anyone know NAFTA?
Yeah.
They refer to it as NAFTA on steroids, an exercise in neocolonialism, and basically a threat to human rights. They contend, opponents contend, that MAI-like agreements would give private corporations the legal status of nation states, and give them powerful tools to enforce those rights, such that governments, local, state, and national, would have to bow to the demands of corporations or be sued. Basically, they contend that citizens and governments are disempowered vis-a-vis large corporations, and the legal power of governments to regulate economic activity in the public interest is undermined. Democratic power, and that was one of the main claims, democratic power is undermined. My study of the MAI, and I've studied it well, confirms this opposition, that the fundamental provisions of this are incredibly impacting and will impact all of our lives. One little example from one session ago, Leroy, one of the other teachers here, maybe you have met Leroy, who's speaking on prisons, spoke about the impact of NAFTA on South Dakota. The impact on South Dakota farmers, because the big grain companies can now are free, regulations are gone, they're free to buy their grain, their soybeans from Brazil at a cheap cost. The farmers of South Dakota don't sell their products. He said, our towns close, our churches close. I said, Leroy, what happens to the farmers of South Dakota when or I said, why does this happen? He said, NAFTA. Have you ever heard of NAFTA, he said? And then I said, what happens to the farmers? And you know what Leroy did? He looked at this with his studier. I said, what happens to the farmers? These are his people. He went like this. He underlined the word silent death. And the impact of this movement to free NAFTA frees trade from regulations. The MAI agreements free not only trade but investment, which means capital flows. The enormous part of economic activity today, the vast percentage, and this is according to economists on all spectrums of the political spectrum, is not in trade, it's in capital flows, it's in investment. So this is freeing the flow of money around the globe from regulations. It's disempowering governments to regulate. That's just my quick summary. And now I want to, and we'll talk about this, I want to give you an example of three provisions of the MAI-like agreements. Keeping in mind that our question is, what does this do to democracy? That is, what does it do to our power to give shape to the common life? And as Christians, giving shape to a common life that serves the well-being of the common good. So this is our question, what does it do to democracy? One of the provisions of the MAI-like agreements is the most favored nation status, which basically requires governments to treat all foreign investors the same, regardless of how those investors have behaved or invested in other countries. It sounds very maybe technical and innocuous, but play it out for a minute. Foreign investment in dictatorships or countries abusing human rights props up those dictatorships. In the pre-MAI world, the world we have known, investment sanctions may be used to discourage investment in dictatorships. What's one good example of that we as Christians know? What did you say?
South Africa.
The MAI, if it comes in place, would eliminate the possibility of doing the disinvestment in South Africa that we did. In other words, the global movement to end apartheid through divestment in South Africa would not be possible if this treaty goes into effect. Yeah, seriously, it would make it illegal. It strikes me that at this moment in history, when consumers are beginning to see, investors and consumers, that exerting pressure economically can stop sweatshops, can stop child labor, environmental destruction, when we're beginning to see that by manipulating the way we invest and consume, we can stop some of the brutality against our neighbors, this is an agreement that's coming into effect to stop our ability to do that. A study by the Human Rights Program at the Harvard Law School states this: the MAI fundamentally conflicts with the goals and objectives of international human rights law. And they're writing in relationship to this undermining the ability to, they're writing about this provision. A second provision, and again it just sounds so innocuous, is national treatment, which basically says that all governments have to treat foreign investors the same as we treat domestic investors. Doesn't sound like a big deal. Basically, though, countries throughout history have distinguished between domestic and foreign investors in order, for instance, to protect natural resources. We don't want foreign investors to come in and strip mine or take away the forests or make their own rules about labor. We might favor, for instance, Seattle might pass a law that gives tax breaks to small, minority-owned businesses in the ghetto areas of Seattle. This provision would make that impossible. A foreign corporation could sue Seattle because it's giving favor to domestic investors in Seattle. Or the Native American lands. This law would give a foreign corporation the right to come in and expatriate, take away 100% of the profits from mining on native lands. without hiring Native people, without investing at all in the Native community, but just taking out the resources. That's now not possible. And this would make that possible. Another provision is called banning performance requirements. Performance requirements are things like labor standards, environmental standards. Performance requirements are the things that say you can't dump a certain amount of toxic wastes in the rivers of Washington State. Washington State can make a law. This treaty would enable foreign corporations to sue Washington State for environmentally sound performance requirements. There's another provision, and this is the last one I'll say, called, what's it called? Ban on uncompensated expropriation of assets, which essentially means that if a government, national, provincial, state, or local, makes a law that inhibits the future profits of an international corporation, the corporation can sue that government. An example under NAFTA is that the Exxon Corporation sued Canada for millions of dollars because Canada banned the transport across its territory of a toxin. It's a toxin that is currently banned in California and other states. But Canada banned it. Exxon said, you are inhibiting our future product, our future profits, because this is a product made by Exxon. And according to the provisions of NAFTA, that's a little piece of what this MAI would be, Canada, Exxon could sue Canada and won. Now, what is that going to do about states and nations and cities' willingness to ban the transport of toxic wastes? Your city could decide to ban the transport of a toxic waste and be sued by Exxon.
Can I ask, where do they sue? How
where do they sue?
A country?
They sue a country according to another provision, which is investor to state, what's it called? Investor to state dispute resolution. The investor, the corporation, under this provision can sue a state. In all previous history of humankind, the corporation would have to go through its own government, and that government would sue the other government. This allows the corporation to sue, and the suits are dealt with. What's that word? Heard, treated, I don't know the verb.
Resolved
in a tribunal that is appointed with, see this, that is appointed and is not including elected representatives. According to this, the proceedings of those tribunals are not, cannot be made public, and the decisions are not contestable.
And where would that happen? Would it happen in the United States?
No, that I can't answer that question. I don't know the answer. If I had the agreement with me right here, I could tell you, and I didn't bring it along. But that's a very good question.
The power comes from the fact that the governments voluntarily agree to the agreements, whether it's NAFTA or NIA, right?
Now that is a very, very good point. You said the governments agree to this.
Yeah.
But this treaty was being made by 29 governments. And it was being made by the negotiators from the US government were from the US Trade Representative, a department of the government. So governments might make it, but only 29 governments were making this. Now, the nations of the world were going to be subject to it. So we have to wonder, and we'll go more into that, but you're right, governments would agree to this.
Wouldn't our Congress have to sign off on it or ratify it?
Yes, Congress would, and Congress also, I read documents, got up in arms at a certain point. But look at NAFTA. I mean, Congress signed off on NAFTA. Why did Congress sign off on NAFTA?
Republicans and Democrats both thought it was wonderful.
Okay. And we could go into why. We could go into why they sign off on it. We could go into who is funding their campaigns such that they sign off on it. We could go into why citizens didn't stand up and say,
well,
don't
sign off on it. The labor movement did, but it was too weak to affect the outcome.
The labor movement did. You're right. You're very right. And the labor movement has stood up around this also. I would say that one of the problems is people don't know. I mean, people are starting to get it now, the implications of NAFTA. A lot of people are getting the implications of this. But this is your comment. Just, I want to take that to bring back us to the point of economic literacy, that it's incumbent upon us, if we love earth and neighbor, to know what's going on in this kind of thing. Your question I appreciate, because I don't know the answer to it, and I will find out.
Cindy, it's just a clarifying question then. Mm-hmm. You said the 29?
Yes.
The 29 representatives are from representatives from government, not corporations of particular nations.
Yes. And now we're looking at this specific treaty and where it was being negotiated in the OECD. It is 29 governments. Now, let's move on to that. Let's just take what you just asked, Ron, and move to that process of, and your question about the governments agreeing on it, the process of negotiating this. I have made the claim that the provisions, the content of this treaty is anti-democratic. It takes away from governments power to regulate economic activity. But I would suggest that the process, you talked about government signing on to it, you talked about 29 nations, also is anti-democratic. And let me just sort of illustrate that. The Secretary General, no, we call it the Director General of the World Trade Organization, made a statement. No. Take a step back. Take one step backwards. I want to look at the contrast between what we're saying and other international agreements, UN-related agreements. UN-related agreements are, at least supposedly, not made by big business. They're made by nations. The UN Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States, I believe it's 1974, includes this. And this is affiliated, this is one of the charters affiliated with the really groundbreaking Human Rights Declaration of 50 years ago that Eleanor Roosevelt helped to put together. All nations have the unalienable right to regulate and exercise authority over foreign investment. No state shall be compelled to grant preferential treatment to foreign investment. Do you remember the preferential treatment provision? National governments have the responsibility to regulate and supervise the activity of transnational corporations in order to serve the economic, social, and environmental needs of their people. This is a UN, actually the quote ends here, I paraphrased this part, in order to serve, just to be exact. This is a UN established treaty. Then we have a statement made by, regarding the MAI, by the Director, Secretary General of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, who said, regarding the MAI, we are writing the constitution of a single global economy. This is the MAI. Now the questions I would raise about how this is negotiated, coming from these two questions, is one, what does it mean for the Constitution to be negotiated by unelected representatives of the 29 richest nations in a relatively secret process? A global constitution. We just have to wonder the implications of that. Secondly, I would ask, what does it mean when the primary consultants to this negotiation process are large business coalitions and lobbies? Who's shaping a global constitution for a global economy?
Where does that quote at the top come from? Did that come from the MIA?
No, that comes from the Director General, Secretary General of the World Trade Organization, which is the newest big international institution regulating international trade and investment. That was his statement related to the MAI. This was one of the statements that the Canadians kind of plastered around the world to critique the process of negotiation. And then the other question is, what does it mean for this constitution if it transgresses international agreements established by the UN, such as the one we just read? I'm not answering those. Obviously, they are rhetorical questions. They're questions meant to raise the point that not only the provisions in this agreement, but the whole manner in which it is determined is at least suspect. If we value, as we talked earlier about democracy, the power of people to initiate public policy, to have a voice in shaping public life. Whether you agree with me or not, let me simply say I believe that something is suspect here and warrants our attention if we claim to value the common good. I'd like to just raise some questions for discussion. I know I've said a lot. Let me just summarize. In sum, I've suggested that the dominant model of globalization, which is corporate-driven and aimed at free, unregulated trade and investment, legally removes from people the power to have a say in decisions which determine not only our well-being and the life chances of our grandchildren, but our sacred, God-given relationship to neighbor and earth. The power to shape public life is placed in the hands of large, unaccountable corporations. For Christians, the commitment to serve, love, and life through our democratic participation is integral to our moral, spiritual life. Globalization subtly but distinctly disables our capacity for that democratic participation. It disables our capacity to choose embodied love by serving the common good. That's my thesis. My suggestion is that in the face of this movement, subversive activity is called for. The subversive kind of moral activity that has been a part of Christian tradition for 2,000 years, in the face of systems of domination that serve death rather than life. We could throw open just discussion here. You could raise questions, or I could raise a couple of questions. Let's comments, concerns, questions, disagreements, agreements. Let's hear what, if folks have any. Paul.
It's fascinating. This is really fascinating stuff. But it seems to strike me that the way to stop this kind of thing, it sounds like, is to fall back on something which is maybe not every bit as insidious, but has not served us very well in terms of that, and that is nationalism.
Interesting.
To protect our,
and that
for Christians, that's a foreign thing in itself.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
is that? So, I guess my question is, where do we stand mm-hmm. in the Christian community that doesn't have to do with protecting our national borders, our national rights, and da 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 da, which you know where that leads us mm-hmm. to no good too.
Mm-hmm.
But on what other ground can we stand?
Yeah.
I think that's an excellent, excellent point. I could speak to it, but others...
I'd like to say something like that. Oh, what you said was that the Canadian and the French used the internet to get... their voice was heard. That was a democratic process. The internet is enabling a democratic process. In other words, people got educated on... If they went on the internet, they heard this revelation about what's going on. The voice was heard in the public forum of the internet. There was a voice speaking out against it, and it was heard. The corporations could not stop that voice unless they brought the whole internet down, which they aren't going to do. But one of the interesting things is that the governments are trying to use regulation to regulate the internet because they don't want this free flow of ideas across national boundaries. This kind of human voice coming. They want to have it controlled for economic free flow, but not for free flow of ideas. So there's an interesting, and they've recognized, I think, if they want to be anti-democratic, that the internet is a threat. And so there's already, policies being negotiated about how do we stop this kind of free flow of ideas on the internet.
Other thoughts related to this question of nationalism, or other questions, concerns?
Well, the French, French opposed it under the protection of their own cultural milieu. Mm-hmm. What do we call that?
Well, it's interesting that you would say that. I was thinking the same thing. That was a nationalistic response.
That's a form of nationalism.
Uh-huh.
I mean, nationalism does not have to be inherently wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there can be the good that comes out of it, perhaps.
Well, and I mean, here we could really have another 2-hour discussion.
Yeah.
You're so right. One can name very good and very problematic aspects of nationalism. I guess one way to think about it, is nationalism the only alternative? Today, at the cusp of the 21st century, is nationalism the only alternative to this kind of single global constitution of a single global economy, or are there other ways to look? Ming.
Well, I would submit that we are all victims of this manipulation on the part of the corporations. We talked about that in our sessions on affluenza. Those of us in the affluent countries are victims of the effects of the materialism and over consumption patterns that we're engaged in, and the people in the third world are the victims of the companies that are exploiting them to produce the products that we consume. And somehow the people in this country as well as in those third world countries need to recognize our victimhood. We are all being used, and there should be a way to forge some kind of solidarity based on that understanding. That
so
it's
you're,
us against them.
Okay. You're talking about cross-national alliances, aren't
yeah.
you? You're talking about alliances of human rights that cross national borders.
I would question that perception somewhat. I chafe a little bit at the thought that we are victimized by Madison Avenue. I don't believe there's anyone that's ever been forced to go to a mall or to consume or to do those kinds of things. I think there's a deeper issue in that victimization statement, the greed that lies within us that has enabled these demonic forces to become powerful. I don't think we can blame them for that which we have perpetrated, in a sense.
Well, here's another good discussion. Are we victims or are we perpetrators of it? Or are we both?
Well, there's a bothness in it.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we choose to consume 4/5 of the resources. Nobody is forcing us to do that. We find that to be very compatible to our lifestyles. And what could shake that predisposition in us other than a spiritual regeneration that would be unprecedented?
Okay, you're pointing to some kind of spiritual power to subvert that the situation of that kind of consumption. Another hand.
Another example, we're not really victims all the time because the World Trade Organization, I think some of you maybe a while ago, Europe was boycotting our beef because of the hormones and antibiotics.
Right.
But we went to the World Trade Organization and got a judgment that now we can slap imports of on a lot of European products. Now that, is our problem. We're protecting our beef growers.
Yes.
And so we're using the organization to our
benefit
now.
And Europe was irate.
Mm-hmm.
Europe was irate. That's a very good example. The World Trade, I can't remember what the outcome was.
We got quite a bit, though.
But Europe was protesting the import of what they considered toxic beef.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. beef companies went to the World Trade Organization and said, rule in our favor.
Our government actually did it, but in behalf of
them. On behalf of them. That's a good example.
The WTO did rule in our favor.
Did.
We can now export
toxic beef. Well, no, Europe, there. I know a lot of Europeans working on this kind of these issues, and there was a lot of displeasure there. But that's a very good point. But where our power lies, where does choice lie when we are subject to the bombardment of advertisement? Where does my kid's choice lie? How much choice does he have to want or not want Star Wars toys?
Oreos.
Oh. Dear Oreos, give me a break to read you an Oreo quote. I just gotta do it. There are a lot of quotes here. Do you mind?
Go ahead.
Oreos.
I read it on the Holden bulletin board over in the kitchen.
What did it say?
And it's Oreos are owned by Nabisco, Mr. Nabisco, and I mean, that's where I think the questioning whether we are victims is maybe valid, but I'm not really sure. I think that that's maybe being a little arrogant about how much power we have to know, especially these things that are on purpose kept secret from us. I mean, this was done in secrecy so people wouldn't know. Mr. Nabisco doesn't advertise all the products he sells that are made as a result of exploiting people so that we won't know. And in that way, we are victims, because how can we be complicit if we don't know? We are, but there's a strong portion where I think we are victims of the secrets that are kept from us by people who have a lot of money and power.
I want to say something about...
I want to just see if there's someone who hasn't spoken yet that had a comment. Okay, Woody, and then... Or, you know, you didn't speak. Go ahead.
I think if we knew, we would still be complicit, because I think we're bought off. We have a very good life because of this system, and the system is set up to make sure that there are educated and influential and professional people who are getting a very good life because of the way the system works, to have 9/10 of the people in the world living in abject poverty and there to support a very good lifestyle on the part of a 10th. And the scenario that I resonate with is that in about 20 years there will be about 9 billion producers in the world and about 800 million consumers. And if we're among the consumers, we're going to have a very nice life, even if Bill Gates and a lot of other Bill Gateses are worth $90 billion. We won't mind if we still got 2 homes and 3 cars and can send our kids to college and a lot of other things. And it seems to me it comes down basically to regeneration of our inner persons. And the first chapter of Paul Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, again, you must exercise the values of the oppressor from within your own soul. That is the first step. We have got to renounce the fact that we are being bought off by a very good life.
Well, then, I want to hear from you, Woody, because you had your hand up. I also want to say I'd like to take that and hold your statement right there and have it be a kind of segue into the second question, wherein in our tradition, if it offers us anything, it must offer us the power for that regeneration.
That's so, Christian faith is in regeneration.
Okay, well let us keep that. I mean, I wish I could have written it down to use it for the opening of the next session or the next session, but I think I value that comment and that statement. Yeah. I know that there was a hand here, Woody, so let me...
Okay, I would actually follow on that I think that's true. We are bought off, or at least a part of us, you know, the influential part of the country, like the United States, when a person representing the United States goes to this OECD or the World Trade Organization and say, I speak for the United States. Well, they're claiming quite a bit to be able to speak for all, you know, several hundred million of us. But he gets away with it, or she gets away with it, because enough of us are bought off not to challenge that that person's speaking for us, because we get enough out of it. And one of the interesting things I want to just make my comment is, that reminded me of what you said about the Jews. It says, the Jews killed Jesus.
No, I didn't say the Jews.
What you said was that the Jews is an incorrect statement. It's the religious leadership.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And it's the same thing that the Americans support NAFTA.
Oh, I see.
Well, it's not the Americans that support NAFTA. It's the economically powerful corporations that support NAFTA. But they hide behind a label of America supports this. We, the people, support this.
I hear what you're saying.
And so I see a connection that we are co-opted because we're bought off, and we allow a label. We don't challenge the label saying all of America supports, you know, the war in Vietnam.
Because, I see what you're saying.
We're bought off.
I think there's truth to that. I am conscious that we only have a few more minutes, so I want to take one more comment, and then I want to just say one thing before we close.
I appreciate what you said, that you questioned the thought, if we only knew, we would act. I think, in addition to the word, we have been bought off, anesthetized is another word. Our wealth and our consumerism anesthetizes us to inaction. I'm offended and horrified at the secrets that are kept from us about Nabisco and the tobacco industry. But what horrifies me even worse is this anesthetizing that has taken place in me of the inaction of what I do know, i.e. the U.S. is the greatest exporter of death of all the nations in two major areas. One, of course, is arms, what are we doing about that? The other is cigarettes. And I don't mean that in a facetious way, but what that does to the infrastructure of a nation that is unable to cope with the consequences is disastrous. And yet, what is being done? And when Congress reins in the tobacco industries, there's no contention made of foreign exports. I mean, it's not the unknown that is killing, it's the known that we don't act upon, to me.
Okay. You have made, I think, a really, really important point. And it is a good point, seriously, I'm not being rhetorical, to move into a closing. A couple of comments that I'd like to make, specifically related to that. First, I just want to read the Oreo quote, if you don't mind. This is by the then chairperson of Nabisco, who owns Oreos. It's a quote from 1960 Forbes magazine, when Lee Dixon was the chairperson of Nabisco. And he looks forward to the day when, quote, Arabs and Americans, Latins and Scandinavians will be munching Ritz crackers as enthusiastically as they already drink Coke or brush their teeth with Colgate. And it just struck me as one of the indications of the cultural problem, the problem of cultural integrity, that the goal. And I have another one about Coke's goal, some quotes from Coke, about Coke's goal to have Coke more available than water fountains throughout the world. You can see ads for Coke showing two Japanese women drinking tea, and another one sitting with them drinking Coke, and her smile is much bigger. But what I wanted to say, related to what you said you're concerned that even though we know we're anesthetized and don't act, and I this kind of session makes me nervous. And it makes me nervous because I personally know really well despair. I know that looking at this stuff can lead to jadedness, hate for your own people, despair, or running away. Running away primarily into private morality. I will be as good as I can to my family and my friends and my church, and just run from the rest because it is too big. And I have experienced that despair. I mean, I have. And I don't want to nurture despair in any human being. So I want to just share with you a framework that I see as bearing hope. And one is that we have some tasks before us. We are all theologians. And our task is to take our tradition and read this crisis in the light of our tradition. And it seems to me that one thing our tradition calls us to do is to have eyes to see and ears to hear. Jesus, have you not eyes to see and ears to hear? Which means seeing what's going on, asking ourselves, what is going on? So that we are no longer blind, we're no longer subject to the secrets. Dig in. Secondly, we need to ask ourselves, in other words, we need to clear our vision of what's going on. Secondly, we need to say, how could things be different? We need to clear our vision. What is the song? Our young women see visions, our men prophesy. We need to clear our vision of how the world could work otherwise. And though it's not present in the public discourse, it's not in the newspapers, it's not in our conversations, there are alternative visions, sophisticated, well thought through, out there, about how business can operate, about how international trade and investment can operate towards the well-being of all folks and the earth. So we must not despair that there are no alternatives, because there are. The task is to begin to read them, see them, hear them, and bring them forth in everyday conversation and to our politicians. So first, ask what's going on, and we become literate. Secondly, to have clearer vision about what could be going on. And some of those visions and voices come from the third world. Some of them come from far-sighted economists and business people today. But the third question, and this is the one that you brought to, even when we see what's going on and when we know how things could be different, it just seems as though we keep on going the way we're going, that we're on a trajectory and we can't get off of it. And it's exploitative and it's earth endangering and we keep on. And that just seeing how things are and how things could be different isn't enough. That as a society we're morally malformed towards ways of economic injustice and we assume them. And that our task is to reform and that somehow there is power. Not only norms, not only what we should do and how we should be in our faith, but there's power. And it's the power of God promising to live within us and among us, within us as community and as Protestants who have kind of shied away from the indwelling God and all. I really believe we need to start reclaiming, glimpsing into the promise that this fiercely loving God has breathed God's self into us, and we need to start knowing it as communities, because I don't think we can alone, and claiming it. It's a life-serving power, and it's a power that has defied so much death for 2,000 years. So I think there's tremendous hope for becoming unanesthetized by claiming the promise. That's how I wanted to close. We do need to close now, but we can carry on informal discussion.
The WTO meets in Seattle, November 29th through December 3rd.